Garrett Edelstein here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. From professional trumpeter to musical entrepreneur and performance coach consultant, Glastonbury to Google, James Wilkinson has worked with many of the world's most famous music and media companies as a musician, producer, manager, and music supervisor. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got James Wilkinson. Where do we find you in the world? What's happening in your life and how are you doing?
I'm in London, West London, Richmond. It's quite leafy around here. It's a bright morning. It's been sort of changeable, but I think we're good. We're good for the day.
So now let's rewind to the very beginning of your entertainment journey. At what age did you think, cool, I want to travel this route in this journey? And how does that accumulate to where we are today?
It depends who you ask. If you were to ask my parents, they would say, you know, it was when I took a long sort of probably about a meter and a half post horn, you know, the old fashioned post horns that they used to, a bit like a sort of very long trumpet without valves. And at 2 years old, I was able to make a sort of more meaningful noise than most adults. From 2 years old, I was pestering my parents to play trumpet. But as a lot of people know, with wind instruments, it's not advisable to give children instruments too early. So I couldn't start until I was about 11. It's all to do with teeth and development and stuff like that. From then, I just quickly romped through the grades until I got to around sort of 15, 16 years old and did my grade 8. And my trumpet teacher started getting me professional gigs. So whilst I still had the Saturday supermarket job in the evenings, I would be going and playing trumpet, getting 50 quid in my pocket. And, you know, maybe being bought a curry and a beer and at 15, 16 years old, you know, that was ace. That was amazing. So I sort of thought, there might be something in this. And I'm making a decent amount of money because 50 quid back then, my dad was giving me about a fiver a month or something. It was a huge amount of money. That's kind of what got me thinking that music may be a career for me.
And what attracted you to the trumpet of all instruments?
I'm actually quite introverted in my sort of, you know, I do like to sort of recoil and retreat and recover after sort of social events. So I think picking something that was loud, and I did a lot of orchestral trumpet playing. So it was that was certainly in my youth. You make a wrong note on the trumpet and you hear it. So I think that was to make up for my introvertedness. I picked a sort of very extrovert, noisy instrument that didn't matter if you had a whole orchestra or band, you could still hear me if I made a mess of things. And so it kept me on my toes. Yeah.
So you mentioned you played with the orchestra and you played with bands. So what's the difference between those two? And would you prefer one or the other, or equally the same?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I was very classically trained as a musician early on, and it was only really when I went to university that I sort of got to know the difference. I was playing in youth orchestras and things like that, and traveling, you know, we did some sort of tours around Europe, and it was just lovely to really just have that power of an orchestra behind you. I mean, a band has a lot of power, but there's just something about a truly organic experience of an orchestra, as opposed to sort of maybe an amped up electronic version of things that I've done in latter years. And I really enjoyed that as a sort of as an experience. And also when I got into university, I was doing music at university. I was then pulled by a friend of mine, now a dear friend, who's a film composer. He got me he just said, he had a jazz band. He said, come and play. I was completely scared of playing jazz, playing pop, playing anything. You know, I was very straight laced when it came to playing. And I was worried that, you know, I was just going to make a big mess up, because as a classical player, it was all about getting it right, not being heard doing anything wrong. When the music stopped, you stop. You know, you don't sort of, there's no sort of odd note that suddenly pops out at the wrong moments. And I'd had some terrible near misses in my teens with orchestral playing, you know, where I'd been sort of tarantara and I'd sort of maybe was slightly behind the beat or something. And I'm there going pop and the rest of the orchestra stopped. You know, it's crushingly embarrassing.
Yeah.
So you learn that you need to be a little bit square, a little bit straight on these things. And so joining a jazz band was, it was like a total square popping an E for the first time. And joined this jazz band. My friend said, don't worry about it. I said, "Where's the dots?" He said, "There are no dots. You just listen to the music. You know, there's no music there. The dots, I mean, by the manuscript." And so he allowed me to just sort of mess about for the first couple of things. And I was sort of still a bit stressed about sort of getting it right. And so my comment to him, and I remember this because I knew it was cheeky. I said to him, "Don't tell me what key the piece is in. I obviously don't even tell me what piece it is. You start and I'll play. And I will try and do it all by ear. I mean, after all, it's jazz. So the first note can be blue, right?" So basically, this guy sort of looked at me thinking, all right, we'll give it a go. And it was great because, you know, I was quite good at bending notes. So, you know, I'd be slightly then bend to the right. They all thought that was cool and that was, you know, jazzy. I kind of cut my teeth doing the jazz stuff, and people started realizing I was more of a meaningful player for bands and things, and some people were doing covers and some people were having originals projects at university. So I would just sort of join in and just sort of play whatever was needed, really. And then it was before I finished university, I was traveling back to the West Country where my parents lived, and I kind of grew up just between Bath and Bristol. And I was in London now at university, this thing, and I've remained since. Crossed paths with an old trumpet friend of mine from Bath. And he brandishing this sort of very cool record, which had a tiger on the front. And I thought, "Oh, that's a cool record. What have you been up to?" He said, "Well, I've just been playing with this unsigned band at the moment, just on Radio One, on one of the sort of live sort of shows." And so I was like, "Wow, that's absolutely amazing. This is a guy I used to sit in orchestras with, and he's now on the same journey as me, getting into this sort of playing outside the box sort of thing, playing off the dots." And so we had a good chit chat, and I sort of said to him, "Well, that's really cool. If you need an extra trumpeter," just literally threw it as a passing comment. So this band had started getting signed, or in the process of getting signed. There were lots of different mouths to feed, and I suppose this was several months later, and I'd just left university and I started working for V2, which was a record label after he sold Virgin, and I was just working in a sort of lowly grub job. And he gave me a call. This is my friend Neil gave me a call, and he said, we need another trumpeter. We're doing a gig at the Jazz Cafe in Camden." So I was like, suddenly getting a bit twitchy because I thought, wow, you know, the Jazz Cafe is like world famous venue for jazz. You know, in a venue like that, I'd sort of messed about with my friends' sort of jazz bands in smaller gigs, but this was sort of, I suppose, big time playing outside of my comfort zone in non-classical. And so I was brought along to this band. We had a sort of half an hour rehearsal. Here's the part. Nothing written down. He would sort of hum it to me and whatever, and then I'd try and sort of remember it. And then we've got the gig tonight. That's it. Go and have a beer and just get it right. Okay. So the Jazz Cafe is very cool. It's got a little gallery and there's some stairs down the side. And this band, they were only playing four songs, and I was only playing on one of them. And so the trumpeters, when the song kicked in, we walked down this sort of stairs on the side and then walked onto the stage, all kind of bopping along to the music and all this sort of stuff. And then we sort of lined up and sort of hit play, really, and just went for it. And of course, you know, that then got me sort of in as a session player with this band. And that night in the audience, there was also A&R from V2. There was A&R from various other companies there. And they were sort of, you know, "What the hell's our little marketing bar assistant guy where runs the sort of cafe and what the hell's he doing up on stage with this band that we want to sign, this really cool band?" And it was the Beta Band. And of course, in the 90s, the Beta Band were, you know, middle page spread in NME. You know, they were the band that you came off stage. And I remember in 99, you know, come off stage and there's Noel Gallagher in the dressing room. It's all that kind of stuff. You know, very, very, very cool. The band that other bands wanted to see and had influence. They were famously synced in High Fidelity, you know, in that record shop scene where the guy basically says, "I'm going to watch me sell these records," and he puts it on, and then people came up to him and, "Oh, I want this record, I want this one." So of course I was there playing with this cool band, you know, this sort of this classical geek, suddenly playing this very cool band. And I wasn't part of the band as a main fixture. I was just on, it was just the sort of sidelines of really getting in and playing with, just playing when they were in town in London or occasionally around different things or when they even had really big gigs. So, you know, I did get to do the infamous, famous, and the wonderful Glastonbury, which I'd only ever been a punter. And So stepping out onto that stage was really where just seeing a roar of people as far as you can see was probably, you know, an absolutely amazingly, liberatingly ecstatic buzz that I just didn't, I think I had one beer afterwards and I was just on cloud nine. You know, it was just one of those experiences that carries you on. I probably quote two times in my life where I've never felt quite so high in just natural high. Well, one time was that, and the other time was when I asked my wife to marry me. Just incredible experience. And it sort of set me, you know, to a long story short, but that really nailed the coffin for me.
From that point on,
yeah,
after the Beta Band, how yeah. did the trumpeting and the playing of the music continue? Did you carry on doing with other bands, other session work?
In 2000, actually, which was my last gig. So I actually had a vein in my mouth, which sort of it corrupted my playing. I had it operated on. They tried to sort of do something with it. It didn't do very well. It actually damaged my embouchure. And even though I got that back and I was able to play, it just meant that the muscles around the left side of my face were weakened. And it just meant I didn't have any stamina. I couldn't play for more than 10 minutes. I persevered. I did try to rehabilitate, but it just wasn't coming back. And obviously on a professional gig, I couldn't just sort of turn up and have that fail. This is the piece of equipment that I need to do this job. And I was in sort of significant equipment failure here. So yeah, with quite a heartache, really. I had to sort of turn my back on what had been nearly 10 years of a career.
Yeah.
Because I'd sort of started in my early teens and really, yeah, so that was it. And kind of set me on course to sort of see what I could do to help other people in music, to help them in various ways.
You mentioned helping other artists or performers. So mm-hmm. let's unpack that. So the people who do not know the differences between who are not in the music industry,
yeah,
what roles did you play and what do those roles encompass?
I wanted to be close to musicians, and I thought if I can't play, then maybe getting in the studio, recording them, making sure that they can be represented properly, you know, sonically. I'd been around live music and studios, and I sort of knew that that was something that I didn't actually have a lot of expertise in other than being the performer side. So actually in 2001, I did a year's training in sound tech and got my chops up on that, and then started sort of doing a bit of work within a studio. But very quickly realized that the sort of late nights and the studio work and things like that just wasn't really my bag. It wasn't going to be my thing. You know, I was away from my fiance at the time, and we had a wedding that was being planned for 2002. And I just thought this is not quite right for me. I was glad of learning. You know, I was glad to be able to walk into a studio and just see all those flashing lights and know exactly what to do. But I just knew that I wasn't going to be there, you know, being the pilot in that particular venture. 2002, got married, and that sort of got me sort of thinking, right, I need to sort of knuckle down, get a proper job. And so I ended up working for Boosey & Hawkes. So, and they're obviously one of the world's oldest classical music publishers. With my classical knowledge, it was easy to slot in there. And also my musicianship. I started working in the hire department. So that was hiring out scores to orchestras and liaising with lots, sometimes conductors or organizers of orchestral stuff, which was really good. And then obviously I moved on to start working in sync, because like the music industry, everything gets all shuffled around periodically. And whilst I was there, I wasn't being made redundant. My job was being moved to Mainz in Germany, which wasn't where I was wanting to live. And I mean, nothing against Mainz. I mean, I hear it's perfectly okay. I think it's just a sort of out of towner, but it wasn't, you know, like you're going to move to Berlin or Hamburg or somewhere cool. You know, it was just, it's a bit out of town and just a bit ordinary. And I was in London, and you know, my life was here, so that really wasn't going to happen. And so I sort of looked at what else was on offer, and there was a sync job going. You know, it was quite early in the sync world. And this really keys into sort of mostly what I've been doing in publishing the last 20 years in sync and licensing, particularly into the film, TV and advertising worlds. That really allowed me to truly help musicians to be able to take a musician from scratch, get them to write something, whether it's a jingle, whether it's a score for, a film, TV, advertising type stuff, or to just license some of their tracks or reversion their track. Again, use a lot of my musical abilities and just stretch them a bit and learn how to license them into stuff and get that going. So really, that's been my bread and butter for the last 20 years. And the journey's been through Boosey and Hawkes, which was obviously a great way to cut my teeth. And then BMG. BMG then got reshuffled, and Universal then bought them. So I was working for Universal for a little bit just by default. And then it got to around sort of 2007, and I was, doing really well, getting lots of syncs, huge commission work and all that kind of stuff, and really helping the musicians. There was one musician, I remember a story. There was a situation where I had some of the guys in BBC. They stormed into Universal. Who the hell is this James Wilkinson? Why is he taking our flagship program and our flagship composers and just messing it all up? I then get hauled into my boss's office. No, James, what is this all about? What is this all about? What are you? The BBC are obviously a huge client of ours. They're one of the biggest clients we've got. What are you doing? And this is one of their biggest flagship things that they do every year, the big natural history thing. Why are you even stirring the porridge here? And so I said, well, and this is where I sort of remember trotting out the phrase, you hired a musician first and foremost, and I'm afraid there's, some bad behavior, and I probably was effing and blinding and saying it in a lot more forceful at that point, because they were getting quite heated. And I really thought, they were being quite mean and totally screwing up this composer. They'd basically sort of said, here's the budget. But you need to spend it all on BBC orchestra and BBC this. And by the time we crunched the figures, the poor composer was probably going to have to pay for the opportunity. And we all know how sick that is in the music industry. Yeah. So I ended up basically pushing for him to eventually get not only a double album done on Universal, but also get, it was actually a program called Wild China. So we actually got the London Chinese Orchestra to come and work with the BBC Orchestra. We made this fantastic double album, which he was on. I mean, he was already a reasonably good composer, but it wasn't very long before he was getting Ivan Novello's and various things like that. And also the album that we made with the BBC was then relicensed, and more money was made for the company. So, of course, everyone was really happy and patting me on the back, because the Beijing Olympics, of course, were just around the corner. So we double bubbled on that one. So, of course, sometimes you just got to sort of pop the old school boil and just sort of get all the dodgy stuff out and clean it up and motor on, really.
Yeah. Your thoughts of, previously we had CDs, we had vinyls, we had cassettes. Those are making a massive comeback, which I'm very grateful for, because I love me a CD. But we've got these digital platforms, streaming platforms. Your thoughts of the differences between the two, and do you prefer which one?
Financially, I thought certainly CDs and vinyl and tapes to a certain extent. I mean, I see tapes that, they're nice, but the thing is, obviously CDs and vinyl are superior sound qualities. So a CD and vinyl are, and they still are, obviously, they are the most superior to anything we've got out there. We don't have a mechanism, sadly, for digital to really pay musicians adequately. I think it was Snoop Dogg hijacked a media conference quite recently to shout about, I'm paraphrasing, but he was talking about having a billion streams.
Yes.
And why doesn't the artist get £1 million for that?
Yes.
And talking about how, he would have found it much harder to even have started, and I do think it's quite criminal that it hasn't really worked. Piracy, yes, was one thing, but actually we now have institutional piracy. Because it seems that the music isn't trickling down to the musicians in it at all, unless you really are a sort of huge superstar, like sort of Ed Sheeran, or someone who really does have billions and billions of streams on all their stuff. And of course, they will always be seen by the performance rights organizations to as part of the the bankers that's gone through the glass ceiling. Yes, we will pay those artists, but if you're a small guy who's done a few thousand here and a few thousand there, you've really got to fight for those pennies that you're going to get through. And if you imagine that you could, even if you used to sell 100 CDs for £10 each or something like that, that then funds your petrol, your van to go to the next gig, maybe to buy some t-shirts or whatever, you know, that's gone to a certain extent. This revival of having CD and vinyl back and having artists, particularly bigger artists, I've noticed it now, are standing next to the merch stands after gigs, huge artists, and they're happy to spend half an hour doing a meet and greet. Some of them, if they're a real superstar, they might have these VIP tickets or maybe you pay a bit extra for a session with them, because obviously if you're in a stadium, they can't just stand there for hours and hours and hours, especially having done a gig. I've been to places where there's 400, you know, maybe 1,000 capacity with a reasonable size artist. You know, they'll stand there for, you know, an hour, hour and a half, and they'll just be signing everything. A, it makes everybody buy the merch much, much more, because they all think, oh, great. You know, and they get a little chat, and, you know, and they get a thank you, and they get, you know, to hear that connection. And I've really seen an uptick in this since COVID. And I think it's just, I think that has helped really bring that connection or that need or want for connection back. And again, you have connection with a physical product. If you're just there stroking along your sort of cassettes or your vinyl, and you suddenly pick something out, and then you can just look at it and you can read the back of it while it's playing, or, you know, whatever, you know, rather than just having Spotify boobling on in the background, that's it. It's almost, you switch off and it just becomes, it's not a special occasion. It's like when you put a record on, you put a CD on, you sit down, you know, and you can have that moment. And also, you're probably going to listen to the whole album as it was intended by the artist. And you can really get into the mindset. What was the story they're telling here? You know, and that sort of thing, rather than just having playlists full of odd little tracks here and there. Mm. I mean, I don't think we're ever going to go back to that sort of album thing. And I'm not being overly nostalgic. You know, I do think progression is important. But for goodness sake, let's pay the artists now. The experiments worked, or the experiments taken over what the status quo that was. Now let's pay the artists.
So it's interesting you're speaking about the downloads and that, because I was at a concert this past weekend. You know, I'm very comfortable going to concerts by myself, and I made some friends, and I was explaining to them that, did they know that an artist gets like 0.005 cents, or however much ridiculous money they get per stream? And they're like, no, we didn't know that. And I said, so when you see the artists going on about, oh, they got 500 million or they got whatever streams, they got like £1,000 or $1,000 or $2,000, however much it works out to. And all these people completely shocked. And it's interesting that there's a disconnect in the communication, because also what happens is I see the artists, I've got 500 million streams on, you know, downloads and this, you know, they see it as a accomplishment, but then they don't also say, oh, well, I only got $2,000 as well. So I mean, it creates this confusion by the listening audience.
I agree. And I think that if artists were to leverage the public and allow them, you know, a bit like Snoop Dogg, this little clip went viral. You know, and I think that's great that the public are starting to cotton on to the fact that there just isn't, it's not actually translating what they're doing. And convenience, you know, has just outweighed sort of business logic.
Yeah.
And for a lot of artists, I mean, they're almost treating records. And I remember hearing someone, an exec, a few years ago at a record label telling me, it was at Pierce, and they were telling me, well, you know, the record's really just it's just a marketing tool now. You know, it's like, you know, it's just an awareness tool. When you have sync and when you have live, you know, it just gets people down to the gigs and gets people. And that's why also at the same sort of time, you had the ticket prices starting to shoot up, you know, 10, 15 years ago. Suddenly, if you were seeing an artist for maybe 50, 60 pounds or equivalent of, and then you suddenly now that same artist, you know, you might be 200 quid or, you know, or 150 or whatever for those artists. And that it's really just so, but there's been no conversation with the public. There's no conversation with why that's happened. It's just so the public are thinking, why are these artists, you know, on their ivory towers and their high horses? You know, why are they suddenly ripping us all off, the fans, blah, blah, blah? And actually, the reality is that, as we've discussed, you know, that it's one of the last areas where they can actually get some money back. And of course, touring and gigs, and especially if you're doing it in a very big sense, costs a fortune, costs a lot of money. So they have to get their money back somehow. If Spotify was switched off tomorrow, what would happen? I get the feeling that suddenly these torrents would get hold again. And, you know, I'm not an arbiter of doom. To be honest, I don't care, actually, because if they're not getting paid anyway, then why should anyone get paid? Why should there not just be file sharing, a bit like, you know, when people used to make a mixtape for their friend. That was file sharing, very slow format of doing that. You've got people or burning CDs or whatever. I remember talking to a guy, he was 21 years old. I was at a wedding a couple of years ago, and he's still at, just finishing university. And he said, I've got nearly 500,000 tracks on my computer that I've downloaded. And I started thinking, well, you know, say they're 70 pence per track. Where the hell has that kid got all that money from to do that? Yeah. Obviously, I knew he hadn't paid for them. But I suddenly thought, that's a lot of money that's just fallen out of the system just because he managed to download them off some torrent and then his mate, he shared them. He probably can share his whole catalogue, you know, now with computers the way they are and cloud and everything. Probably within 10 minutes, he probably just basically send that to someone. That's a lot of money dropping out of the system. That's just one kid with his record collection that he's got for nothing. And that's more than some artists might earn in, say, 5 years starting up their career.
That's stealing. I mean, it's a, what a lot of these people don't realize is that they're actually stealing.
Yeah.
But they're like, oh, why should I have to pay for it? And it doesn't sink in to them that they're stealing and they are damaging the industry even more.
Sure. They don't understand that there's been now these torrents things, you know, for 20 odd years now, we've had institutional stealing and now it's just whatever going on. Everyone thinks about having a crack copy of X, Y, and Z, you know, whether it's software, whether it's music, whether it's whatever. And people don't see it as a problem. I mean, one of the first things that some people do, oh, where can I get a free download of that? And this goes back to your point about physical, you know, having a CD. If you had a CD-ROM of the software or the music or the whatever you would, the film, DVD or whatever, you know, that's tangible. When it's just a file that you're sharing, there's a massive disconnect with the value in that. It's not actually worth as much. For instance, we go back to the example of the kid with 21, nearly 500,000 tracks. He no doubt has probably not listened to most of them.
Yes.
He's probably cherry picked maybe several albums out of it. But even if he was just to pay for the bits that he did pay for, and just really enjoy it. When I was buying CDs, CDs were 15, 16, 17 pounds, buying CDs in the sort of 90s. And that was a lot, that's a lot of money out of my student school budget, whatever, pocket money. So I would cherish what was I going to buy. I would go to a shop, probably invariably something like HMV or one of these sort of big shops, and I'd be browsing through. And occasionally, if I felt a bit flush, you know, and a band was in the right sort of ballpark of the types of music that I liked, you know, occasionally I would take a punt on buying that album just on the basis of what I read on the sleeve, or I like their artwork, you know, things like that. Very occasionally, but I'd have to be feeling quite flush to do that. Otherwise, I would be quite considered. You know, I'd have read some stuff, maybe, I mean, pre-internet, right? So I may have read some stuff. Maybe I'd heard it at a friend's house. I didn't think about, I want to have this on a tape. I thought, I want to have a copy of that record because I really like that artist. I had no concept in my musical education and my sort of education to think that music should be free or was free.
Totally agree.
But now it's been devalued to the point where it is perceived as free. If you can listen to Spotify and put up with the adverts or any of the similar sort of streaming services, you know, it is free. And prior to that, you wouldn't get so much stuff. You'd record something off the radio, maybe. What is the answer to suddenly go immediately draconian and put down the, as soon as you do that, we're in a world of everyone just saying sod off to everyone. And I just think that we would just drive everybody into extreme piracy. If the streaming services, they cost an amount to put on, you know, the tech, the storage, the music, all that stuff, that's fine. I do think there needs to be a bit more discerning about what goes up there. I mean, now anyone can put anything up.
Yes.
You know, and we've even seen this with the advent of AI. So obviously people are trying to make money and they've cottoned onto it and they've taken a few bits and bobs off it. But really, you know, people are creating tracks and just throwing them up there on all the platforms all at once. And, you know, thousands and thousands of tracks, which is just rubbish. There's no quality control anymore. So, of course, that, again, is an own goal. That devalues the music that is good up there. And look, okay, you know, who am I to say what's good and bad? Someone might really enjoy some sort of slightly sketchily recorded bad sort of demo sort of thing, but then that's absolutely fine. And I'm completely cool with that. And if there's a following for it, it deserves to be there. But I think there's a, we're just gone in the wrong direction. It's a malignant growth within the industry that's just spiraling out of control. which has zero benefit, really, other than PR and promotion. And even then, what PR and promotion? What do they care about? You know, maybe they'll get a better record deal next time because they've got a squillion more streams.
Yeah.
Well, that's the case because people are very data-driven. And that's part of some of the stuff that I do if I'm doing working with companies with A&R and things like that. You know, we do look at the data of an artist, but we've also got to look and consider, actually, do you know what? I love this artist and I really want to help them. Can't really see them going hugely far. I can't see them making us a lot of money, but I want to help them. So there's been times where I've reached down and pulled someone up and given them a little bit of a voice just because I like them. Nowadays, my advice to artists is, well, if you're good, get your following, go and do a load of gigs, go and get 300-400 people in six cities, go and stand by the merch stand, sell a load of merch, sell a load of records to them genuinely. You know, even if they nail your record, your vinyl to the wall and then still listen to you on Spotify.
Yeah.
At least you sold them something physical. At least they know that you're real.
On a positive note, as a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
I'd like things like, you know, Bandcamp and things like Patreon and various things like that. You know, I think you've got there's a small artist out there that you would love to support, that you would like to help, go see them live, go and buy their t-shirt, go and, you know, if they have a Patreon account, you know, drop a fiver in a month so they can buy themselves a few cans of beans.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever is needed, maybe be aware, just be aware, you know, that music has an innate value to culture. And without music, there would be no soundtrack to your life.